is best to really have a clarity on it and the situation on ground. So I'm really honored for this interview to be able to share the little I know.
On the record with the First Lady of Nigeria, as we press into the reality of the persecution Christians are facing there in the African nation, and to probe what the Nigerian government is doing to protect its own people from religious targeting. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. One of the most dangerous places in the world for Christians today is in Nigeria. U.S. President Donald Trump redesignated Nigeria as a country of particular concern just 4 months ago for its severe violations of religious freedom. A recent House resolution that's been proposed to condemn the persecution of Christians in Nigeria paints a grim picture of the reality there. Looking at the numbers, it is estimated between 50 to 100,000 Christians have been killed for their faith in Nigeria since 2009. More than 7,000 Christians killed in 2025 alone. There are an average of 35 Christians murdered every day, with more than 19,000 churches having been attacked or destroyed. There are frequent news reports of mass kidnappings in Nigeria targeting Catholics and Christians, even school children, being taken away. Earlier this month, a parish priest in the Archdiocese of Kaduna in Nigeria confirmed the parish's catechist, his very pregnant wife, and 30 other people were kidnapped in a bandit attack. It's just the latest example of such a tragedy. On Monday, the House Appropriations Committee and House Foreign Affairs Committee delivered their joint report on the persecution of Christians to the White House. It outlines several concrete actions to help end the persecution and growing extremist violence, including establishing a bilateral U.S. and Nigeria security agreement to protect vulnerable Christian communities, withholding certain U.S. funds until the Nigerian government can demonstrate it's stopping violence against Christians, and demanding the repeal of Sharia and blasphemy laws, among other recommendations. It is with this reality as the backdrop that EWTN News in Depth received an invitation earlier this month to sit down with Nigeria's First Lady in Washington, D.C. A former senator in her own right, she is also a Christian pastor, married to the Muslim president of Nigeria, Bola Tinubu. She pushes back on claims that Christians in Nigeria are being targeted. Here is my on-the-record interview with Nigeria's First Lady, Oluremi Tinubu.
We're honored to be joined today by the First Lady of Nigeria, who also happens to serve as a Christian pastor at the largest church in Nigeria, a very respected woman. First Lady, please, where are you?
Nigeria's First Lady, Oluremi Tinubu, was on a bit of a whirlwind diplomatic tour in the U.S. Capitol early this month, a move that made some religious freedom advocates weary.
The First Lady was here. She was here this week.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, they wanted to come on the program to talk about religious freedom. Yeah. And I said, I'm not going to give them I'll meet with them. I'm happy to meet with anybody.
Same here.
But I'm not going to give them a platform to cover up what they're doing in Nigeria.
And that's just what it is, a massive cover-up.
I'm really honored for this interview, to be able to share the little I know. You know, to visit, to also share some of the worrisome news that, you know, that has been going through the social media for some time.
You are in an interfaith marriage. Your husband, the president, is Muslim. Can you speak about that interfaith dynamic in your marriage? And was your family surprised when you married a Muslim man?
Nigeria has a population of over 250 million people, diverse culture, and also multi-faith. But I'll talk about my marriage, like you said. Down south, predominantly Christians. We have Muslims also. And most Muslims and Christians intermarry. And going to when I introduced my husband to my dad, who knows more about faith than me then, my dad said, "You are Muslim. I hope you won't stop her from going to church." And he said, "Never." So, and then, you know, in the marriage, you know, marriage is challenging, but drove me to know more about the Lord.
You've brought up this theme of multi-faith and yes. how that is lived out in Nigeria. And Nigeria itself is home to extraordinary diversity, as yes. you've said. And there are three major tribes in Nigeria, if I understand yes. this correctly. Hausa Fulani in the north, the Yoruba in the southwest, and the Igbo in the southeast.
Yes.
Communities, each with distinct cultures. But when we are
and there are various challenges too
in each one, and in when we do one. Look at these reports of Christian persecution specifically, it seems a lot of the violence and intimidation is most acute in the north and in the middle belt
in the Christian states.
And so, as a Christian and as a First Lady, what do you say to Christian mothers in the north specifically? Who fear sending their children to school, and how do you rally the rest of the country amid, you know, the diversity to stand up for this as well?
You know, one thing I would say is those three states mm-hmm. are actually agrarian states. Hmm. The best lush greens for any cattle rearer will be envious of. Hmm. As Christians, we are supposed to have God fight our battles. Christianity says the weapons of our warfare are never carnal. It's only through God that we fight, and which is more a spiritual fight. We pray and believe and have faith that God will fight our battles. But inside Christianity, do you have evil people? Mm-hmm. Muslim, do you have evil people? Yes, there are evil people around the world. And so when envy comes in a mind, and a thief will come to steal what doesn't belong to them. Mm-hmm. So it's first started as herders farmers conflict in all these areas. And it has been going on for decades.
So what do you say to those Christian families who are scared?
You see, that's the thing that, you know, all this has a lot of elements to it. Mm-hmm. And the government is trying to find a lasting solution. Mm-hmm. So I personally will not tell you that I know firsthand what is going on, but this has been there for a long time. And the military and security agency have been doing their best. But is it enough? No.
Father Don Bosco Anyala, founding editor of EWTN News' ACI Africa, joined me from Nairobi, Kenya, to explain the Nigerian government's response to reports of Christian persecution.
Let me be a bit specific about Abuja, which is the capital city. Abuja has reframed violence affecting Christians as part of general insecurity involving terrorism, banditry, farmer who had clashes, and communal violence, which also affects, they say, Muslims and other groups.
We asked Nigeria's First Lady herself whether she believes there is religious targeting.
You mentioned this long history of the violence that is going on there. Are there groups specifically targeting Christians?
That's what I'm going to tell you. That if you go, you know, you're coming from a Muslim state and you enter a Christian state, predominantly Christian, and then you come in as headers, and also the farmers that are there, there's always a clash. So not that they came out to get Christians, but they came there to feed their cattle on crops that don't belong to them. So that started. And not only that, because of the level of poverty, there is banditry, there is kidnapping for ransom.
This week, an AFP investigation found the Nigerian government paid Boko Haram militants a huge ransom to free hundreds kidnapped from St. Mary's Catholic School in the western state of Niger.
That report, based on multiple intelligence sources, asserts that the government effectively paid millions of dollars in ransom to Boko Haram militants to secure the release of the over 200 children and staff abducted from that Catholic school, and that even two Boko Haram commanders as part of the deal were released.
You mentioned that there still needs to be more done in order to combat these reports that we're hearing. In November, more than 300 school children were kidnapped from St. Mary's Catholic Primary and Secondary Schools community.
And they were rescued.
And they were rescued and released, but the details remain unclear of that release. When you say we need to be doing more, do you foresee there being more transparency moving forward about these rescues?
There is transparency, but what we do need is to have proper security, a security that will be able to secure lives. The number, our number in population is overwhelming for a country that is just growing. We are an emerging economy. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have the resources. God bless us with natural resources, mm-hmm. which were, you know, not appropriately used for the benefit of the country in the past. And now we are now left with a lot of burden. Mm-hmm. Immediately my husband assumed office, he had to remove fuel subsidy, which no government has ever tried. If he didn't do that, Nigeria is in the verge of collapse. We would have gone through a form of revolution. But in our budget, what did the president give priority to? Security first, health, and education.
In November, President Trump posted on his Truth Social that he may go into Nigeria guns a-blazing to completely wipe out the Islamic terrorists if the Nigerian government did not stop the killing of Christians. And on Christmas Day, the U.S. launched airstrikes against ISIS militants in northwest Nigeria in coordination with the Nigerian government.
In my final moment with you in our conversation, can you just summarize what action is the government taking to stop these kidnappings from happening, and will there be prosecutions?
Yes, there are. And what the immediately that all the news in the social media started, and President Trump also issued the statement that, you know, they are going to be placing attack on those bandits. Mm-hmm. What happened was my husband in November now declared a state of emergency on November 26th, to be precise, 2025, mm-hmm. a state of emergency on insecurity. And what did he do? We had to recruit 50,000 policemen, mm-hmm. 24,000 soldiers, 10,000 forest guards who previously were not armed. So they have to be retrained to carry arms. And when we look at all that, the dynamics of it in a population as big as Nigeria, you know, it's overwhelming enough. So, and I can reassure you that Nigeria is in good hands. My husband is doing all he can do to bring sanity to the situation, try to get as many allies. We just pray that things, you know, gets better.
Here now to share their reaction to the Nigerian government's response to Christian persecution and for insight into the reality Christians face there in Nigeria today is our expert panel. Father Remi Jus Ayula is a Catholic priest in the Diocese of Makurdi Benue State in Nigeria. He's been prominently involved in humanitarian and peace initiatives and serves as coordinator for the Nigerian Catholic Relief Organization, Foundation for Justice, Development, and Peace. He joins us from the San Francisco area. Sean Nelson serves as Senior Counsel for Global Religious Freedom with ADF International, where he advocates on behalf of Christians and other religious minorities being persecuted for their faith around the world. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here for this important discussion. Father Remi, I want to go to you first. As a Nigerian Catholic priest, what's your reaction to the Nigerian First Lady's portrayal of Christian persecution in the nation? Are Christians being targeted in Nigeria?
Yes, Catherine, thank you for having me. And thank you, Sean. Good to see you. My reaction, first of all, is a reaction of shock. And I must say that I'm ashamed of myself as a Nigerian to hear our First Lady speak this way. I had the opportunity to meet her in Washington when she came. And I told her firsthand from the experience of someone who has been on the ground. I've been serving in this role for many years, over 15 years. I've carried people who have been hacked down, butchered as if they were animals, thrown away from their homes, people coming shouting Allahu Akbar, like the incident in Yelwata a year ago. So, and the situation of Nigeria's move towards Islamization is very well known. I wonder why someone as high as her who come and speak to the American public and want to be politically correct. I'm not too surprised because many people in politics in Nigeria and the people who are super rich in Nigeria care less about the situation of persecution of Christians, even if they are Christians themselves. You have not seen pastors of mega churches come out to condemn the persecution of Christians and stuff like that. It is a few people who are risking themselves and speaking about this. One of them is my bishop, Bishop Anagbe, whom you know very well, who always speaks about this issue.
Right.
We have been tracking this dive into Islamism and the desire to take over Nigeria and push away Christian populations for a very long time. Now it's common knowledge. And you know, now with the media, you can no longer deceive people for long. So shocked. I'm ashamed.
Mm.
And I'm very bitter about how someone as prominent as her, who could have been the mother of all Nigerians in this time, and say, look, this is a problem that we have, but we should put hands together and see how we can tackle this problem. She didn't do any of that.
And Sean, following up on that, why is there a narrative coming from the Nigerian government that attacks on Christians are not religiously based?
Yeah, it's been a series of denials for years and years, and it hasn't just been the Nigerian government. It's been the mainstream media that's done this for many years. I mean, only in the past year, and I think especially after President Trump's big announcement back in October, calling out the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, has it gained a lot more traction. You're talking about thousands every single year for year and year on end. This past year, there was recent numbers, about 3,490 Christians killed and targeted for their faith. And that's just the murders. And as Father Remy mentioned, we're talking about putting people into churches, locking them there and burning the churches to where you can't even find out what the numbers are. You're talking about internally displaced persons, mothers and their children being hacked to death. It's atrocious, and it's been happening all the time, every single week. Just this week now in Adamawa State, there were dozens who were killed in an attack there. The denials, I think, as Father Remy said, there is some politics going on. Mm-hmm. Nigeria is roughly split between about half Muslim, half Christian,
right.
And many of those Muslims are in the north, and that's an important political bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to say all Muslims are extremists or violent.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely
mm-hmm.
wrong. And where, especially in the south, Muslims and Christians have gotten along very, very well. In many parts of the north, they get along very well.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a growing extremist ideology that's been growing for about 20, 25 years, and that because the denials of that extremism have been going on, it's been allowed to fester. So that's been just an atrocity.
Atrocity, and hopefully more attention is starting to get paid attention
Absolutely.
To right now. Father, I want to go back to you. Can you tell us what kind of threats and violence do Catholic priests face in Nigeria? And is the Nigerian government enabling persecution to continue, in your opinion?
Well, to say they're actively enabling persecution to continue may not be a correct framing, but I do think that what they have not done is that they have not shown a willingness to tackle the problem headlong, because this problem has not started today. Look, Catherine, the problem with the religious extremism in Nigeria has gone back many, many decades.
Mm-hmm.
There is a story of Mitatsine started in Kano, and all true. Then Boko Haram came, Lukarawa came. As I speak to you, the most deadly Islamic movement is the Fulani militants.
Hmm.
And a lot of people don't want to call them because they think that, okay, if you say Fulani militants, you are painting the whole tribe with a brush. But they are Fulani, and we just have to call them by what they are. We're not saying all Fulani are into this, but many of the people who come into the Middle Belt, especially and Southern Kaduna and the Benue State, where I come from, and other parts of the Middle Belt to kill, are Fulani militants. So we must call them out. But the tracing of Islamic jihadism and the desire to make our country Islamic by all means necessary, both violent and non-violent. We're all talking about the violence. There is also the non-violent element component. They have implemented Sharia in many states. As I speak to you, it is Ramadan. Some people cannot walk freely. Some days ago, a young lady was beaten by three gentlemen in Kwara State. They claimed that she didn't cover her head because it's Ramadan and things like that. Schools are closed during Ramadan, for heaven's sake, in a country that is supposed to be secular. There are many other things that are happening. But to speak to the threats you're talking about, priests have been killed. In my own diocese of Makurdi, two priests were gunned down celebrating morning mass. Gunned down. Last year, a fellow priest, again, Father Solomon Atongo, I'll call his name, was shot and left in a pool of his blood. They thought they had killed him. So these are the threats that priests, and in other dioceses, priests have been killed, seminarians killed, in the rectories. They attacked even the rectories. It's not as if this is hidden. It's not hidden. You go to churches and you kill people, and then someone comes out and says, oh, there's no attack on Christians and Christians. It's laughable.
Oh, my goodness, Father, that those stories are horrendous. Sean, we mentioned that Trump recently redesignated Nigeria as a country of particular concern. How are U.S.-Nigeria relations right now?
So that happened back in October, and the initial reaction from the Nigerian government was pretty hostile. But over time, I think, as there was more attention paid to it, it just became so undeniable. And the point of these designations is not just to say, you're a bad country, we don't want to work with you. The point is to help the people who are being killed, to help the people who are being kidnapped, and to make sure that religious freedom is protected for everybody. And that's a real value. It's an American value. It's an international value. And it's a value for a lot of Nigerians. And so this has moved into a more cooperative stage. I think that's a very positive thing. There have been some recent recommendations given to the president from Congress, Congressman Riley Moore, Congressman Chris Smith, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, different committees. They've really put a lot of effort into this with great recommendations. I very rarely have seen such incredible effort from an administration as I've seen right now with Nigeria. And there has been good responses, I think, from some portions of the Nigerian government. There have been some personnel changes and things. Interest in improving security, interest in helping the IDPs. You know, Father Remy and you both mentioned the issue of Sharia criminal law, blasphemy laws, mob violence. That can lead to the death penalty there. It's a really terrible thing. There's a number of different issues, but those recommendations, if they're followed through, could in the next few years really
make a huge
difference. But they have to be followed
through.
They
have to be followed through. Father, finally, my last minute with you, I do want to ask you this. The Vatican announced this week Pope Leo will visit Algeria, Angola, Equatorial Guinea, and Cameroon this year, his first major overseas trip of 2026. How significant is this, and what are you anticipating from our Holy Father going to Africa?
First of all, Catherine, it's very significant because Africa is the place to go to now for the growth of Christianity. You know that very well. Nigeria has more than 90% of Catholics going to Mass almost on a daily basis. The faith is growing in Africa. Africa is once again becoming the center for the growth of the faith. So it is really, really good to see that Pope Leo has wasted no time to visit Africa. I wish that Nigeria would have been on the list. I really longed and prayed that Nigeria would be on the list, but I do hope that in a very short while he will come to Africa. The reason is that on these visits, he's able to encourage the Christian faithful, especially those who are suffering violent persecutions like Christians in my country, Nigeria, and in neighboring country, Cameroon. Part of Cameroon is also suffering a lot. So these visits are pastoral, but they are also going to serve as encouragement for the Christian body and to inspire others also to begin to take their faith seriously and not to give up in the face of this rising Islamic intent to take over the over Africa.
Yeah. There's so much to discuss. We'll have to leave it there. Father Remy and Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Sean.
And there's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth. Catholic controversy as followers of the Society of St. Pius X, SSPX, make a move to defy the Vatican. Explanation and analysis next. And
it's incredible to be here on this day, the first day in 800 years when public veneration has been possible. He's such an incredible saint, and it's been a very, very moving experience.
A groundswell of love, faith, and devotion at the beginning of a special period to honor St. Francis of Assisi. And inside the Eastern Catholic Church, we visit Michigan to learn about the thriving communities of Catholics whose history, liturgy, and traditions go back to the ancient East, but who are fully in communion with our Roman Catholic Pontiff. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
after weeks of pushback from students, faculty, benefactors, and bishops from across the country, a pro-abortion professor has withdrawn from a leadership role at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Susan Osterman's decision to not move forward as the director of the Liu Institute for Asia and Asian Studies was announced through an email to students Thursday morning. Notre Dame quickly came under fire last month for promoting Osterman, who had called abortion, quote, freedom-enhancing, and criticized the pro-life movement in published articles. Bishop Kevin Rhodes, whose diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend includes Notre Dame, spoke out against the appointment and even led the rosary on campus earlier this week to pray for its Catholic mission. More than a dozen bishops backed his opposition. In a statement released shortly after the news broke, Bishop Rhodes said he was grateful to all the members of the Notre Dame community and beyond who, out of love for Notre Dame, expressed their opposition to the appointment. This is not an issue about academic freedom or scholarly engagement. Academic freedom protects inquiry. It does not require institutional self-contradiction. Osterman will remain a professor at Notre Dame. In the announcement, she says she stepped away because her appointment risks overshadowing the work of the Institute, but claimed there is work to do on campus to, quote, build a community where a variety of voices can flourish. A prominent and controversial traditional priestly fraternity has announced it will move ahead with consecrating new bishops without Vatican approval. The Society of St. Pius X, more commonly known as the SSPX, says the move is necessary to continue its work. But the Vatican and now some high-profile prelates warn the group is headed towards excommunication. The SSPX has had a strained relationship with the Vatican for much of its 50-year history. Based in Acuni, Switzerland, and found all over the world, the group exclusively celebrates the traditional Latin Mass and disagrees with some of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council, particularly on religious freedom and the Church's relationship with other faiths. It reached a new level of controversy in 1988 when its founder, Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, consecrated four bishops, defying a direct order from Pope St. John Paul II. EWTN News Vatican analyst Edward Penton says they were immediately excommunicated. But Pope Benedict XVI lifted that penalty as a gesture of reconciliation in 2009. While Pope Francis later granted SSPX priests' faculties to hear confessions and to witness marriages under certain conditions, the Society's canonical status has remained irregular.
The sacraments are valid. They can hear confessions and so forth, but they are in a regular communion with Rome.
The Society now sees itself again in a similar impasse with Rome after Superior General Father Davide Pagliarani announced on February 2nd it would once again consecrate its own bishops to replace the aging bishops and ensure that its priests can be ordained.
They also talk about an act of grave necessity. It's an emergency situation because in order to save souls, the souls need the sacraments.
In response, Colonel Victor Manuel Fernandez, prefect for the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, hosted Pagliarani for a meeting. He offered to reopen conversation with the SSPX about minimum requirements for restoring full communion under the condition the Society does not move forward with the consecrations. Pagliarani declined, saying the Society and the Vatican would never fully come to an agreement on doctrine. The group is now again at risk of excommunication.
They would be basically similar to any other group that is not in communion with Rome, so like the Protestants.
In the wake of the SSPX's announcement, Cardinal Robert Seurat and Cardinal Gerhard Müller, who have both prominently spoken in defense of the traditional Latin Mass, wrote separate articles calling for the Society to be obedient to the Vatican. In his article for a French newspaper, Cardinal Seurat wrote, "Is it to desire the salvation of souls to tear apart the mystical body of Christ in a way that may be irreversible? How many souls are in danger of being lost because of this new division?" Kazakh Bishop Athanasius Schneider, who previously served as an apostolic visitor to the seminaries of the SSPX, instead appealed to Pope Leo XIV, writing to the Holy Father, "If you grant the apostolic mandate for the episcopal consecrations of SSPX,
The church in our day will lose nothing. You will be a true bridge builder. As the groups navigate this impasse, Penton points to Pagliarani's call for charity.
I think probably if both sides focused on that and the importance of charity between both sides, unless that happens, it's going to be difficult to find a solution.
To provide his perspective on the SSPX controversy and what this latest news means for the people in the pews, we are joined by a familiar face to our viewers. Father Thomas Petrie is a Dominican theologian and frequent EWTN contributor. Father, thanks for being with us. To be clear, let's just start right off. Is the SSPX headed towards a schism if it goes through with consecrating bishops?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, immediately, once the consecration happens, according to the church's canon law, both the bishop who is doing the consecration and the bishops, the men who are consecrated, while they're validly bishops, they become valid bishops, they are automatically excommunicated. This happened in 1988. That excommunication was lifted in 2009. So immediately, those bishops will be excommunicated. The nature of schism is just that. It's about the nature of the relationship. It's not a canonical penalty like excommunication. But a schism is essentially refusing submission to the Pope and communion with the Pope and the bishops united with him. And that is essentially what the Society of St. Pius X will be doing. When the Society began, Bishop Lefebvre said that it was a temporary solution. Now that they're consecrating more bishops, precisely because they no longer see this as temporary, they see it as a quasi-permanent necessity, it makes the problem more significant than 1988, because now you're essentially setting up a parallel church, a parallel structure that is not in communion with the Holy Father.
And Father, a core tension between the SSPX and the Vatican has to do with doctrine. The SSPX views some teachings from the Second Vatican Council as a departure from tradition. Why is it so significant that the Society does not fully align with church teaching there?
Well, I think, to be honest, I'm sympathetic somewhat to their views on this, which is to say, I think we all know that the Second Vatican Council was not a council like, say, the Council of Trent or the Fourth Lateran Council. There were no canons. There were no anathemas. There were no declared heresies, which is usually what councils do. John the 23rd specifically said that he wanted the Second Vatican Council to be a pastoral council. And so that has led, even with clerics and theologians who are in communion with the Pope, to have debates and discussions on what exactly needs to be held as a matter of teaching from the documents of the Second Vatican Council. And I regret that that conversation with the Society of St. Pius X will not go forward, or doesn't seem like it will go forward, because I think that would be helpful to the Catholic Church in general to have more specific laid out. Okay, the second half of Gaudium et Spes, for instance, was very time conditioned. Not everything in it is perennial. But the fact that the Society of St. Pius X not only rejects, I would say, not just some documents, they seem to reject much of the tenor of the Second Vatican Council. And lately, in his most recent communication, Father Pagliarani has said that they reject the interpretation of Vatican II offered by successive pontificates. So the pontificate of John Paul II, the Benedict XVI, Francis, and presumably now Leo, even though we're early in his pontificate. It's hard to see how, and this is what since Society of St. Pius X has said, it's how hard to see how a dialogue about the Second Vatican Council can move forward if they are obstinate in their will on having such a fruitful conversation.
Father, we have about a minute left, but this question is important. Currently, SSPX sacraments are illicit but valid. If the SSPX consecrates bishops, what does that mean for the lay faithful who attend? Could a Catholic in good conscience attend an SSPX Mass?
Well, as regards the Mass, that will depend a lot on how the Holy See responds to the consecrations. Right now, in 2002, the Holy See did say that going to an SSPX chapel for Mass does fulfill the Sunday obligation, provided you're not going with a spirit of separating from the church. The Holy See could rescind that. And certainly anybody who's going to be separated from the Catholic Church are already in somewhat of a state of schism themselves. This is all complicated, of course, by the restrictions that Traditionis Custodes put in place, where the traditional Latin Mass is not exactly as readily as available as it would have been, say, 2 or 3 years ago.
Father Thomas Petrie, thank you for breaking this down for us. We appreciate you.
God bless you.
Thank you. The fourth anniversary of the war in Ukraine, a leading Catholic voice says the president missed something important in his State of the Union address, and more powerful people face fallout from their association with Jeffrey Epstein. News headlines are next in the Week in Review.
Please support Ukraine. Please support our diplomacy for peace and be effective. Every result you achieve is a line that Putin cannot cross. Thank you for all these years.
A standing ovation for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky as his country enters a fifth year in its war with Russia. He addressed the European Parliament via a video link on Tuesday, calling on the lawmakers to set a date for Ukraine's admittance into the European Union as a security guarantee. In a show of support, several EU leaders later joined Zelensky in Kiev for a ceremony honoring fallen soldiers. Without U.S. aid, Ukraine now heavily relies on its European neighbors, who in turn want to guarantee protection from Russia's aggression. The fourth anniversary of the war in Ukraine tops the Week in Review. Russia's full-scale invasion into Ukraine 4 years ago has become the deadliest conflict in Europe since the Second World War, and peace negotiations have still failed to show any substantial progress. Ukrainian delegates met with President Donald Trump's envoy in Geneva to discuss economic support for Ukraine and the upcoming round of negotiations with Russia, possibly taking place next week. Hours before that meeting, Russia bombarded Ukraine's cities with drones and missiles, targeting gas infrastructure and power substations. After 4 grueling years of war and a bitter winter, many Ukrainians feel they have been pushed to the brink.
The world doesn't hear us at all. We are here alone in our suffering. Our homes are being destroyed every day. Children are dying every day, and no one hears us. They may feel unsettled, maybe even outraged, but no one truly understands us. Not really.
Since the war began, more than 1.5 million soldiers have been killed, wounded, or gone missing on both sides. Nearly 15,000 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. Millions have either been forced to move from their home or leave the country entirely. For those who remain in Ukraine, they face the coldest winter in more than a decade. And Russia's attacks on the power grid mean hundreds of thousands go without warmth and power. On the anniversary of the war, the bishops of the Ukrainian Catholic Church in the U.S. have published a strong rebuke of Russia's tactics against civilians. They write, "This winter, the harshest in years, has been deliberately exploited to break the spirit of a nation. Men and women, military and civilians, grandparents, parents and children, standing for freedom, justice, democracy, and God-given human dignity. It is a war against the people. The genocidal intent is manifest. Despite countless deaths and millions of casualties, the people of God resist, trust, and pray. They stand and fight evil and tyranny to live and witness to the truth." The U.S. held another round of indirect talks with Iran this week, but did not come out with a nuclear deal. Without a breakthrough, the White House eyes military action. The talks were held in Geneva on Thursday. Another round is expected to take place next week. Both sides describe the talks as productive, but Iran says it refuses to abandon its nuclear program. As these talks continue, the U.S. is moving air and naval power to the Middle East, its largest buildup of force in the region since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Iran has threatened that if America does launch a strike, U.S. military bases would be considered targets and tens of thousands of American service members' lives would be at risk.
The public safety situation in Mexico has stabilized after these scenes of destruction in the state of Jalisco on Mexico's Pacific coast. Members of a major drug cartel set up multiple roadblocks, set cars on fire, and shot at government buildings in retaliation after the death of the country's most powerful drug lord known as El Mencho, following a shootout on Sunday with the Mexican army. At least 70 people were killed in the attacks, including 25 Mexican soldiers. El Mencho was the boss of a major syndicate known for trafficking fentanyl, methamphetamine, and cocaine into the U.S. In major tourist areas like Puerto Vallarta, the violence frightened tourists, disrupted vacations, and prevented many from getting to the airport to go home.
We're staying in our room, and we're never coming back to Mexico again.
Oh, really? Is this a situation that you made you think that you just wouldn't be safe again if you want to come back?
Yeah, we always thought we've been coming here annually since 2012, and we've never felt unsafe ever, not at one time until yesterday.
The violence happened just miles from the Guadalajara Stadium, slated to host four FIFA World Cup games this summer. Mexican authorities insist the situation will be under control and the matches will go on as planned. President Trump briefly mentioned the takedown of the Mexican drug lord during his State of the Union address on Tuesday. Both the U.S. and Mexico had confirmed that U.S. intelligence helped to support the operation. His 1 hour and 47-minute speech was the longest State of the Union in history, breaking a record he himself had already set. He defended issues in which his popularity has sunk, including the economy and so-called affordability concerns. With Supreme Court justices sitting just feet away, he criticized their ruling last week that many of his tariffs are illegal. And other than a handful of items Trump asked Congress to do, he outlined no major legislative agenda. After referencing the murder of Charlie Kirk, he briefly mentioned religious revival.
We love religion, and we love bringing it back. And it's coming back at levels that nobody actually thought possible. It's really a beautiful thing to see.
And though the president's State of the Union was the longest one in history, the word abortion was not mentioned once. Prominent pro-life leader Marjorie Dannenfelter, president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, tells me that was a mistake.
It was a good speech, as speeches go, as long as it was. But there's a glaring omission, and that is addressing the most urgent needs of the pro-life movement, which he helped lead in the overturn of Roe v. Wade, which he claims many times. The glaring omission is, and the urgent need, is to address the problem of drugs flooding into pro-life states and every state all over the country, causing the abortion rate to rise, killing children, and harming women.
Dannenfelter went on to say this week's address and Trump's distancing from the pro-life movement was a stark contrast from his first term, when she worked closely with the administration to craft bold pro-life language in his State of the Union addresses. You can watch my entire 15-minute conversation with Dannenfelter with more of her reaction to the State of the Union and the state of pro-life politics today on the EWTN News YouTube page. A small group of Jeffrey Epstein survivors was in the House gallery at the State of the Union address, invited there by lawmakers demanding more transparency by the Trump Justice Department in the Epstein case. The survivors of sexual assault and trafficking say they will not be silenced, despite the administration's refusal to release the full Epstein files. And though this Justice Department has no active investigations against the elite group of powerful Epstein friends, some big names continue to feel the heat this week from Epstein fallout. Former U.S. Senator, Nebraska Governor, and Democratic presidential candidate Bob Kerry is named in the Epstein files. He resigned this week from the board of directors of a clean energy company to, he says, avoid damaging the startup's success. Harvard University announced former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers will resign his teaching position at the end of the school year amid a campus review of his ties to Epstein. He is currently on a leave of absence. Summers was the president of Harvard for 5 years. Birgit Brende, the president and CEO of the World Economic Forum, resigned on Thursday, just 1 month after his organization hosted international leaders at the annual Davos Forum in Switzerland. He said the forum should continue its work, quote, without distractions. And in a candid town hall meeting with staff members of the Gates Foundation, billionaire Bill Gates apologized for his association with Epstein, admitting mistakes that had cast a cloud over the philanthropic group. While the Epstein files have tied these powerful men to Epstein, none have admitted any criminal wrongdoing. foreign nations continue to take associations with the Epstein network seriously, on Monday, former British ambassador to the United States, Peter Mandelson, was arrested at his London home on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The release of the Epstein files led to allegations that Mandelson forwarded market-sensitive information to Epstein while he was Britain's business secretary. His arrest came just days after the arrest of former Prince Andrew, also on suspicion of misconduct in public office, passing insider information to Epstein. The British government says it will release all documents to police related to Andrew's 10 years as British trade envoy in the early 2000s. Republicans on the House Oversight Committee did call Bill and Hillary Clinton to testify on the Epstein matter this week, neither of whom has been accused of any wrongdoing. The former Secretary of State told members she never met with Epstein or went to his homes or offices. The former president said he did nothing wrong and that his connections to Epstein ended before Epstein's criminal conviction in 2008 and the sexual allegations against him came to light. It marked the first time a former president has been compelled to testify to Congress and could set a precedent requiring other presidents to do the same. We turn to other news next.
As Jesus said, come and see, come and experience.
Eastern Catholics in Detroit share what makes their churches unique and invite Roman Catholics to give them a visit. We explore some of the most ancient of Christian faith communities when we return. And thousands of people get in line for the rare opportunity to venerate one of the world's most beloved saints. We are in Assisi, Italy, the home of St. Francis. Ahead.
When Pope Leo XIV traveled to the Middle East last November, he met with the leaders of several Eastern Catholic churches, faith communities that are in communion with Rome, but with distinct roots in the East. Though a small group overall, Eastern Catholics are part of the fabric of American Catholicism today and have an especially significant presence in the Detroit, Michigan area. Reporter Jonathan Liedl traveled this winter to Detroit to bring us this Catholic Life report.
A weekday mass in the Detroit metro. But if you're a Roman Catholic, this liturgy might look and sound a little different. St. George's Parish is part of the Chaldean Catholic Church, a community that's fully in union with the Pope in Rome, but has its own distinct liturgy and history. The Chaldean Church was founded by St. Thomas the Apostle in ancient Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq. As Father Fawaz Kako explains, the Chaldeans celebrate the same Eucharist that all Catholics celebrate.
It is the same Eucharist, the same body and blood of Christ, because we are Catholics.
Just expressed in a unique way. For instance, a ritual known as the breaking and signing of the Eucharist.
Before we approach these holy mysteries, we acknowledge one thing. We are unworthy, O Lord. But you make us worthy by your grace to stand here with our unworthiness to break and sign your body and blood.
For the Chaldean faithful, the ability to pray the Lord's Prayer in a dialect of Aramaic, the language Jesus spoke, is a powerful blessing.
I think it's one of the most beautiful things ever. It can bring tears to my eyes.
The Chaldean Church is one of 23 Eastern Catholic churches. Along with the Roman Catholic Church, they make up the one universal Catholic Church. Eastern Catholics aren't Eastern Orthodox. They're as Catholic as anyone else. And several Eastern Catholic communities have a strong presence in Detroit, where the auto industry was a major draw for 20th century immigrants from Eastern Europe and the Middle East. That includes Ukrainian Catholics, who worship here at Immaculate Conception. The Ukrainian Catholic Church celebrates the Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. Some of the prayers are in Old Slavonic. One unique aspect of their liturgy? The bread for the Eucharist is cut into cubes, and after consecration, the body of Christ is dipped in the precious blood and given to the faithful with a golden spoon. Another feature of the Ukrainian liturgy is the iconostasis. As Father Daniel Shaikovsky explains, the gilded wall of icons helps set the sanctuary apart.
We maintain that mystery which is behind the iconostasis.
And the Divine Liturgy is always celebrated under an icon of the Pantocrator, Christ the Teacher. Across town is St. Charbel Church. It's one of the largest Maronite Catholic parishes in the entire country. As Father Chris Nahra explains, the Maronite Church has its roots in ancient Lebanon. Parts of the Maronite liturgy are celebrated in Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic. And the Maronites keep relics of beloved saints in cedar-shaped cases, a tribute to the homeland of their church and of the strength of their Catholic faith.
This is just a small reminder of the faith that we carry from Lebanon into the entire world, especially here in Detroit, Michigan.
Other Eastern Catholic communities in Detroit include the Byzantines, the Armenians, and the Syriacs. But no one has a bigger presence than the Chaldeans, whose eparchy covering the eastern United States is based right here in the Motor City. In fact, there are more Chaldeans in Detroit today than anywhere else in the world, including Iraq, 187,000 compared to 127,000. It's a bittersweet fact, highlighting both the thriving Chaldean community in Michigan, but also the persecution Chaldeans face in their homeland, which has intensified in recent decades with regime change in Iraq and the rise of ISIS. Martyrs are remembered here at the Chaldean Community Foundation. And Chaldean Americans like Dr. Edhid Miri are committed to ensuring that their faith and culture lives on. A historian, Dr. Miri leads the Mar Ibrahim Library, named for the first Chaldean bishop in the United States.
He always wanted to preserve what after. And a library was one of his dreams and visions.
The library, which opened this month, offers Chaldean language classes to young people, helping them connect with the place where their church was born. The library also houses a rare collection.
We have here manuscripts that were brought at different times from Iraq by either clergy, the nuns, or Bishop Ibrahim. We have some manuscripts here that are 400 years old.
Dr. Mary hopes to pass on the spiritual wisdom contained in these texts and is working with museums across the world to preserve and digitize their contents. It's one small way Chaldeans in Detroit are committed to handing on their heritage. Another way? Through food. Here at the Princess Mediterranean Grill, Kenny Ibrahim and his wife Adora serve up Chaldean culture, one meal at a time.
Because the faith is what has kept us together for centuries, right? And then, of course, family. What brings family to a table is food.
The restaurant serves Chaldean staples like stuffed grape leaves, baba ganoush, and kebab, all made with simple spices. But the signature item? A whole roasted lamb. Kenny says that back in Basra, Iraq, his father's restaurant would serve lamb on special occasions in the Chaldean community. Baptisms, First Communions, and especially Easter.
So it's a very tradition over hundreds of years old.
But the Ibrahims also share something else at their restaurant, their Catholic faith. The couple had Princess Mediterranean Grill consecrated to the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Jesus is the CEO of this place and our lives, and it is something that we take very seriously. We feel it's a ministry.
And include prayer as a special ingredient.
We bless our food before these customers pick it up. So all our food is blessed before it goes out.
Showing that for many Chaldeans in Detroit, faith, family, and food are all intertwined. Whether Maronite, Ukrainian, or Chaldean, the Eastern Catholics of Detroit are proud of their unique heritage and liturgies. But they also invite their Roman Catholic brothers and sisters to attend their churches and grow in shared understanding.
As Jesus said, come and see.
Worshipping the same Heavenly Father by different expressions of the same Eucharistic faith. In Detroit, Jonathan Liedl, EWTN News in Depth.
The clergy in Jonathan's story reiterate, if you are a Roman Catholic attending an Eastern Catholic liturgy, you can validly receive the Eucharist. That is something all Catholics share in common. For the next several weeks in Assisi, Italy, an unprecedented opportunity to pray before the relics of the country's beloved patron, St. Francis. A long line of devotees came last Sunday, the first day, to see the bones of St. Francis of Assisi. Except for one brief day in 1978, it is the first time since his death 800 years ago that his relics have been displayed to the public. Nearly 400,000 people have registered in advance to venerate the saint. His bone fragments are contained in a plexiglass case in the lower basilica of St. Francis. Many of the faithful expressed deep gratitude at this rare opportunity, which extends through March 22nd. Pope Leo has proclaimed 2026 as a special jubilee year of St. Francis to commemorate the 800th anniversary of his passing and to highlight his message of peace and fraternity. And visitors to St. Peter's Basilica were able to see new Stations of the Cross installed this week to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the church's consecration. The artist's proposal was selected for more than 1,000 submissions in an international competition. His 14 large oil paintings are hung near Bernini's Baldacchino and will be displayed throughout the Lenten season. I'm Catherine Hadro. As we close this edition of EWTN News in Depth, please enjoy our Images of the Week. God bless.